Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Utterly Unscripted. My name is still Jesse Veritas, and I am your host. Thanks for listening in. I've been receiving some feedback. I've just explained this to my guest, and I wanted you to know that I've listened. So for this episode, I'm trying something a little new, and I hope that you like it. So it's going to be called It's Utterly Almost Unscripted. On today's episode, I'm joined on the main stage by an extraordinary guest. Her story will leave you in absolute awe. Holly Francis is a strong and resilient woman who, just weeks after giving birth to her daughter, Casey, found herself paralyzed and on life support in less than 72 hours. Holly's journey through Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, as I will now call it from here on in, because I'm not good with the names, is a rare autoimmune disorder. It left her trapped in her own body, unable to move, speak, or even hold her newborn daughter. That's not where the story ends. Holly's memoir tells the tale of how she overcame despair, hopelessness, and pain to reclaim her life and become the mother that her daughter needed. Her book is called Life Support, Surviving Guillain-Barré Syndrome, A Mother's Story of Hope and Recovery. That's not laughing at the title, by the way, Holly. It's that name, GBS, and I'm going to get you to tell us exactly how to say it. It's not only a memoir, but it also serves as a resource guide for people who are living with GBS or other autoimmune diseases. I've only read a little bit of the book so far. I actually just bought it two nights ago. But it's truly an inspiring reminder that life doesn't always go according to plan. And we talk about that a lot on this show. Life doesn't always go according to plan. However, with strength, determination, and with a bit of hope, you can overcome even the most challenging obstacles. Holly's journey has touched millions of people around the world through her recovery videos on YouTube. You can check them out. I had a look across her channel, and one of the videos had 19 million views. Like, that's amazing. I can't even get five. The other one had like a few million on there. Her fighting spirit and her resilience are obviously the true inspiration, and that is what has drawn the people to see her incredible journey. So I want you to sit back, relax, and I want you to get inspired by Holly's incredible journey. Now, don't forget to subscribe to our show, leave a review if you like the content. And of course, I've said this all along, if you don't love the content, I want you to hit me up on one of the social media accounts that are going around. I want to know how I can make this better for you. So please don't be shy. I can handle it. I can handle it all. I've heard it all. Now, don't forget to grab a copy of Holly's book and to learn more about her journey after the episode. And we'll also give you some valuable insights on how to care for and support those who are dealing with devastating illnesses. You'll find all the links in the show notes. Including a link to Holly's website, which is hollyaftergbs.com. So without further ado, hi, Holly. Welcome to the main stage, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jesse. Thank you so much for having me on your show. And you did a great job at pronouncing Guillain-Barré. Some people, Guillain-Barré, yeah. Well, it's French, and so it's, you gotta get that French accent, right? But
right.
A lot of people butcher it much, much worse. So you did a very good job.
And I did some research.
And I always laugh because I spelt it wrong and pronounced it wrong for quite a time after I was even diagnosed. So don't feel bad at all.
That's good. I'm glad I'm not the only one. I've looked at a couple of videos where you've been featured, so that's helped a little bit. But I've heard other people butchering the name, and I thought, I've got to get this right. I have to get it right. For me, it shows my respect for what you've been dealing with, and that I understand what you've been through, of course, but that I understand where you're coming from, and I'm willing to listen and I'm willing to learn about it. So I bought your book the other day, and I've had a quick read. So I'm nowhere near finished.
No worries.
Take some time to read, but I also had a look at your YouTube page, and I've had a look at a couple of the other interviews that you've been doing. So you have an amazing story. I guess I have some questions, of course, which like I never used to do that, but I've written down some questions that I thought I would like to ask you, but I would more like to pass it over to you so that you can introduce yourself and let us know what GBS is, because it is very rare.
It is, yeah. So again, thank you so much for having me on. And I'm really excited to share my journey and share what I've been through and bring awareness to GBS. We'll just call it GBS from here on out because it's so much easier.
Thank you.
And yeah, and like you said, it's rare. And so I like being able to talk about it and bring awareness so that people do understand what it is. So it was a disorder that I had never heard of. Majority of people have never heard of it before until I was diagnosed. And so once I was diagnosed with it, then I learned as much as I could. And what it is it's a rare autoimmune disorder. And it's very similar to multiple sclerosis. So a lot of people know that disorder. But similar in that it affects the peripheral nerves in your body. And what it does is it's basically an attack. So your immune system, you know, your immune system will typically fight off an infection or fight off whatever it needs to do. And then it stops, right? But with an autoimmune disorder, it continues to fight and it begins to then attack the healthy nerves or the healthy fatty tissues in your body, basically. And so with GBS, it begins to attack the nerves that are not connected to the brain. So every single nerve in your body basically starts to get attacked. And it happens very suddenly. It usually comes on after some sort of either infection or some sort of just anything that causes it as an immune response. So it can come on after surgery, after pregnancy, it can come on after the flu, a common cold, food poisoning, many, many things can actually trigger it. And so in my case, it was, I had my daughter just 3 weeks prior. And that's what usually triggers something is the 3 to 4 weeks that it takes kind of to process. And so that's what happened with me. And 3 weeks later, I was dealing with some paralysis and it just continued from there. So that's what, that's kind of a gist of what GBS is.
I have heard of it before.
So wow, actually, I'm impressed.
Funny enough, when I saw the introduction, to your story, I went, oh, I have heard of that. I have heard of that before. So I don't know if it's maybe because I also have autoimmune issues that I've maybe run the gamut and read the books and seen different things come up. What I didn't know is that this just came on like, is it hereditary? Is it something that you may have already had a gene or something?
It's not hereditary. They're doing lots of studies to try to figure out kind of why and why it happens to certain people. And we just don't know yet. So there's so much uncertainty about it. But like you said, like you may have heard of it maybe through autoimmune stuff, because it is very relatable to many other autoimmune disorders. But the interesting thing is though it's rare, it's actually not that rare. It's 1 to 2, we're moving up to 2 out of every 100,000 people. So while that sounds rare in a really big city, I mean, that's still quite a few people. And so people are being affected. There are people all over the world that are not only being affected on a daily basis, but also that are dealing with the residuals from years past. So there are tens and tens of thousands of people around the world that suffer from this disorder.
Wow. I'm shocked at that now there's an increase in the number, and they don't know what causes it. They don't know how it comes to be in you.
They don't. And I mean, this is a little controversial, but one of the triggers definitely is vaccines as well. And so, I mean, we've had a lot of vaccines going on in the last several years. Yeah. that might be one of the reasons, although that's not the number one cause of GBS. The number one cause is actually the Campylobacter bacteria, which is found in undercooked chicken.
Really? So, actually, I think that's where you say that now, and it sounds familiar to me, chicken and GBS. I have heard that before.
Yeah.
And it's not uncooked, it's undercooked, right?
Undercooked, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you will see also a warning sign on vaccines that GBS is a side effect.
mind you. I mean, now, and I have to say, because we have been banned before. Of course, the opinions that we express in this show are our own. We're not giving health advice at all. Like, I just want the YouTube gods and everybody else.
Oh, absolutely.
The people who keep flagging me that we're not giving out advice, and I'm not telling you not to go get vaccinated. Of course, you know, get vaccinated. Like,
absolutely.
Do the best thing to help people, like,
absolutely,
us who have autoimmune illnesses, you know.
Yes.
My autoimmune disease is hereditary. It's hereditary. So I can trace it back on both sides of my family, which is pretty crappy. I get a double dose of it. But I also have Crohn's disease, which is another autoimmune disease.
Yes.
And so I have that. And then now at the moment we're exploring that I may possibly have fibromyalgia.
Okay.
Which you discussed this in one of your interviews, and I'm trying really hard to remember which one it was. I didn't make a note of it, but you discussed the, can we talk about when you're home with your daughter, you've just brought home your baby girl, Casey. It's the first 3 weeks of her life.
Yeah.
You said that you were feeling like a tingling sensation. Am I getting that right? Was it in your hand,
yes,
or did you feel it first in your neck?
No, it was in my fingers. So that was the very first basically symptom that I had. But it's funny because at the time I didn't know that. I didn't know that was a symptom. I didn't know what was happening. And it wasn't actually until months and months later that I remembered that I had that tingling in my finger. And at the time I had thought it was just like, I thought I had burnt myself I didn't really know. It was just kind of numb and felt kind of weird. And that was basically the nerve damage was starting there.
People with fibromyalgia will understand that is a common, that is a common symptom. You also talked about, I'll fast forward very quickly and we'll rewind, but I'm just recalling from a couple of the interviews that I heard you talking about, everything that touched you was painful.
Yes.
That the sheets in the hospital were like sandpaper on your skin. And someone with fibromyalgia will understand that is every day. Sometimes the clothes you wear are causing you extreme agony, pain, and discomfort. So you talked about that. But did you Google it? You Googled what was wrong with your
I did. That's what we all do, right? We Google.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me? Why am I sick? What's happening?
Google
to
doctor.
Me? Yeah. So I Googled. Yeah, because then I get this pain in my neck, and it came on very suddenly. Like within like an hour, I'm dealing with severe pain, and I thought that maybe I had pinched a nerve or just slept funny. But it's getting worse. So I take some pain medication. It's not even helping whatsoever. And I'm stretching and go on Google, and it said I had a pinched nerve.
Right.
And so that's what
Google got it wrong.
Assumed. Yeah, Google got it wrong. Well, you think sometimes Google tells you the opposite, right? It tells you you're dying.
Yeah.
But but in this case, it said I had a pinched nerve. And the funny thing is I actually ended up going to a Medi Center, just a little clinic. Because the pain was getting so severe, and the weakness was starting to happen. It started in my legs, and I was just kind of feeling heavy, kind of like when you're getting the flu. And so I had taken myself to the doctors and told him, I think I have a pinched nerve. That's what Google said. And he looked me over really quickly, and he said, I think you're right. And here's a prescription for some T3 medication, and go on your way. So I went home and things just continued to get worse. It wasn't paralysis at the time, but it was weakness in my legs continued to get worse, and my legs felt heavier and the pain in my neck got worse. And when I was walking up the stairs, I was having a hard time lifting my legs up. And again, I was thinking, well, I might just be trying to adjust to this new life as a mom, right? And I might just be really, really exhausted. Or
just so tired.
Yeah, exactly. And I had had a C-section as well. So that happened just three weeks before. So I was still recovering from surgery. And so I just thought, you know, it's probably nothing. I probably just go to bed tonight. And when I wake up tomorrow, I'll feel great and I'll be fine. And I went to bed that night and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't. The pain was just too severe. And I was laying in bed and ended up crawling out of bed and laying on the floor thinking that would kind of help. And I was doing some stretches and I was Googling yoga poses, all these different things that I thought would help a pinched nerve. Yeah. Of course, nothing helped. And hours go by, and at about 3 a.m, my daughter was, she was in a bassinet beside my bed, and she woke up because she needed to nurse. And I stood, and my legs completely gave out on me and completely buckled, and I fell to the floor. And that was when I was like, I don't know if this is a pinched nerve. I mean, if it is a pinched nerve, it's a pretty serious one.
Severe. Yeah.
That I'm having a hard time walking. But I think I need to go to the hospital.
Thank God you live in Canada.
Yes.
For those who don't know, Canada, just like Australia, has universal healthcare.
Yes.
which no shade on the doctor who first saw you either. I mean, it's not like he could just go, let me look in your eyes and I can diagnose you with GBS. We understand that, you know, it's not, and I know you're not throwing shade on the doctor. I get that. All of the symptoms pointed to you having a pinched nerve. So in reality, he was doing what he thought was best.
Exactly.
For you at the time, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, realistically, GBS, it's still rare for doctors. Some doctors have never seen a case of it in their careers and may never.
Okay.
So I certainly don't shade that doctor by any means. And I think that's why it's important to kind of share our stories and bring that awareness so that they can learn more about it.
Yeah. Can you talk to me about it was important to mention that you did have a cesarean section. That is major surgery for men who are listening who don't understand that a woman is practically being cut in half. And trust me, all you need to do is go and watch like One Born Every Minute or one of the very many YouTube documentaries that show these things happening. You'll probably never want to put your wife or girlfriend through it. You know, it's pretty horrific. It's pretty horrific. And I feel a lot of empathy for someone. You know, I don't understand how that is, and I will never understand that because I will never be in that position. But just I've the most dramatic thing I've ever had done to me is an ingrown toenail being removed. You know, like for me, I've been very lucky, so I can understand that it's very serious. And you were saying at the beginning that GBS can be brought on from things like surgery, like illness, things like that. So,
yes,
I mean, in the end, did they say that is probably what it was that triggered your GBS?
Yeah, they think it was likely either childbirth or the surgery, or maybe a mix of the two, right? Like you said, it's impossible to say for sure, but that timeline, typically it follows like a 3 to 4 weeks, and it was right in that time frame. And it, like I said, it does come on very typically after pregnancy as well. And so that's kind of what we think was my trigger,
Yeah. Were you, was your C-section emergency? Was there trauma?
A little bit, yeah. So basically I was in labor and I mean, everything was going really well and smooth and no complications or anything, but she just, when I was trying to push, she was not coming out. She was just at a weird angle. And so it wasn't like an emergency, but it was like, you know what, she's not coming out and this isn't going to happen. So we're just going to do a C-section. Everything went great with the C-section. And when she was born, she was completely healthy and I was completely healthy. And so it really didn't matter, even though at the time I was like, I don't want to have a C-section. I didn't plan for this, but you said, we never plan for any of this, right?
No, exactly. And the important thing is that you're healthy and well, and you don't want to put too much stress on the baby. We see it all the time. We're very lucky now that we have insights into these things, you know, stuff that while I was growing up, we never had shows like One Born Every Minute. Are you familiar with the show?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're now very lucky that we get to see these things. And I guess the ultimate important thing is that the mother and baby are well, and that's why they have these procedures in place. And
exactly.
And so 3 weeks later, you're feeling like you've burned yourself. You've got a pinched nerve. And 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to the emergency room.
Yes. So I had So I had my husband at the time. We're divorced now, but I basically was like, drop me off at the hospital. I've got this really bad pinched nerve and I'll call you in a couple hours.
Of course, as you do, you would do that.
Right? Yeah. Like, yeah.
You've got a newborn baby.
I had a newborn baby. Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to bring her into no ER and it's going to be chaos in there. And so I said, you stay home with the baby. And I'm sure that there is some formula somewhere in the house because I was breastfeeding at the time. And I said, I'll be back in a few hours. And I kind of stumbled through the doors because I was having a hard time walking and it was feeling kind of weak. And I walked through the doors and I had no idea that it would be another like several months before I would even walk out of those hospital
You
doors
didn't
again.
Walk out of that hospital again that evening. You did no, not go I home did that not. Evening.
No.
What what is that like? I mean, did the GBS progress so severely that they just were like, you're not going anywhere, or you physically couldn't and there was no choice?
Both. Pretty much both. So what happened is I went in and I was able to connect with a doctor quite quickly. I was very lucky that it was very quiet that night. Mm-hmm. And the doctor was so honest and forthcoming and said, I have no idea what's wrong with you, which is scary. When you go to the hospital, you think they know everything, right?
Yeah.
We're like ingrained to think that doctors are like the smartest people in the world. And he's like, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I'm going to find somebody that can figure it out. And so a neurologist came down to see me and he was testing my strength and he was testing basically like my nerves, right? And checking how my sensitivity was and all that, and checking how weak my legs were and my wrist strength and my basically my reflexes in my legs. And once he was finished, after about a minute and a half of doing this, he said, I think I know what you have. And I kind of stared at him and just waited. And it was kind of running through my mind, like, do I have cancer? That was kind of the first thing that I thought. Yeah. I don't know why.
I didn't even think like that.
I don't know. I just thought like, okay. And he said, well, we're going to do some more tests before we know for sure. And so it was kind of scary because it was like, well, why aren't you telling me what it is?
And
so I ended up having.
What is it you're not?
And
telling
what
me.
Is it? Yeah. So he said, we're gonna get you in a gown and we're gonna get you admitted into the hospital, and which was very foreign to me again. Like I'd been in the hospital a few weeks before to have a baby, but other than that, I had been pretty healthy my entire life, and so spending a lot of time in a hospital was just very strange to me. So I'm gowning up, and we end up like doing several different tests and doing an MRI, and I end up getting a spinal tap, which is ultimately what diagnosed me. So very similar to an epidural, just a little bit placed a little bit differently in the spine to take out the fluid. And that's how they diagnose GBS, is that the protein levels are basically higher than a normal person's. And that's how I was diagnosed. So at that point, even before I was diagnosed, the paralysis was starting to spread through my body. So within even a few hours of being at the hospital, I couldn't walk anymore. So I was bedridden. And I remember I was thinking I needed to get up and use the washroom, and I couldn't, and nurses were having to help me. And it was very traumatizing. Yeah. They told my family they basically told me to call my family and tell them to come to the hospital because I probably wasn't leaving anytime soon. And I just remember thinking, like, I've got a newborn, I got to go home, I got to take care of her, like, I got to breastfeed her and everything. And they basically warned me that once they had the diagnosis, they said, GBS is a very, very rare disorder that we don't know too much about. And we don't know how it's going to progress. Some people have mild cases and some people actually do walk out of that hospital that day or the next day, or maybe who knows. And so they said, you need to basically just kind of stay here and we're going to watch to see how this progresses and how this unfolds. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm sure that you're just going to give me some medication and I'll be home tomorrow. Yeah. And of course, the pain is starting to take over. The pain was very, very severe. So the nerve pain was, like you described, that sensation with your clothes touching times 100. And it was just getting worse. And so they were giving me heavy narcotics. And I just remember just kind of being really, really out of it, not really understanding. And I was very sleep deprived. But it happened very, very quickly. And within 72 hours of arriving at the hospital, the paralysis spread up my body and I could no longer breathe anymore. And I was basically rushed to ICU.
Wow. On a ventilator.
Yeah. On a ventilator. Yeah.
I'm not sure now if you mentioned it here. You talked about the GBS attacks all of the nerves that are not connected to the brain.
Yeah. So basically all the nerves that are not including the brain. So all not the nerves the in brain. The body.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. But what does that mean, Holly? Does that mean that you've had this experience where you're trapped? And when some people, if they're not able to breathe on their own, they're on a ventilator, they're unconscious, whatever, they probably are not feeling what's going on. But for you, that it sounds like it might have been very different. You were probably experiencing everything.
It was very different. Yeah. And that's why I also really like to share my stories, because I think a lot of people think, oh, you were paralyzed and you were in ICU and you were on life support and you were probably sedated and you were probably sleeping the whole time. That was not the case whatsoever. Yeah. So, I mean, the first several weeks I was heavily sedated and I don't remember everything by any means, but a lot of the time I was awake and I knew what was going on. But like you said, I was trapped in my body. So what it does is it paralyzes you because the nerves aren't able to transmit signals back and forth between the brain. And so your body just cannot move. So nothing on my body, basically from the neck down, was able to move. I still was able to move my head a little bit. At one point it actually did spread up and affected my mouth and affected my eyes, but that only lasted for a few days. But otherwise, I couldn't move a single thing, complete paralysis. Wow. And I could hear everything going on around me. And I understood what was happening. And the doctors were amazing. And they were telling me every detail and keeping me informed of what was happening. But it just felt like everything that I had worked so hard for was just gone in a split second. Like I just had my whole entire life planned out, and I just recently bought a house and just had a baby and was married a few years before.
Holly, my gosh, everything was happening all at once.
And then all of a sudden, like I'd barely even got a chance to spend time with my daughter. She was 3 weeks old and we'd barely even left the house. In Canada it's like minus 30. You guys have got Celsius, so you know what I'm talking about. And so it's minus 30. And I hadn't even introduced her to some of my friends yet. Like we just hadn't even had a chance to start our life. And so then I find myself in ICU on a breathing tube. The breathing tube is through my mouth. So I can't talk. I can't communicate. I can't hold my daughter, and my family's all there. Everyone, of course, all my friends and family rushed to be by my side. And I just thought that I was dying and I was never going to make it out of there.
I want to talk about that because none of us listening, well, I would say that very few of us listening have ever been in a situation where we felt despair, because I can imagine that you were probably feeling pretty desperate. Like the desperation you would have felt was intense. And also because you couldn't communicate, you couldn't verbalize anything, you couldn't even breathe on your own. So how did you find the strength to go from that to the very different person that you look now? Because I'm going to feed into this stereotype of, well, you don't look sick. People say it to me all the time. You don't look sick. And I mean no offense. I've been there. I've done the depression. I've got anxiety. I have PTSD. You don't look like someone who has been through an experience like this where you couldn't move. I've watched the videos of you being lifted out of your bed because you couldn't move. They had to get a lift to get you out of the bed and put you in a chair and keep you moving. And how did you get from I have a pinched nerve to, by the sound of it, within weeks, you may have in your mind been thinking you were going to die. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that is pretty intense and pretty confronting.
It was very intense, and it was something that I was not prepared for at all. And all of a sudden, my life was what I felt like was over, and there was no hope. And even though the doctors were telling me, you know what, people from GBS do recover, they do get better, and they get out of ICU. When you're in that hospital bed and you've got a ventilator and you're struggling to breathe, and you every single breath feels like might be your last, it's hard to believe. And so I honestly,
how can you believe it? Yeah.
I honestly thought they were lying to me for many, many weeks, and I was angry for a while because I was like, "Stop lying to me! Just let me go. Stop fighting for me." I actually tried to get my parents to shut off the ventilator because I said, I can't handle this pain. There's just no hope. And so I didn't have hope for a while. And it was a very dark, broken place to be. But, you know, there was these little tiny moments that kind of kept me going. And one of them was, I remember my family plastered the entire room with pictures of me and my friends and my daughter and just my life before all of this happened. Yeah. And I remember just staring at it and just wanting so badly to get back to that and wanting to get back to being a mother and getting back to just finishing all the things that I'd always said I was going to do and just live my life. And so it was like, that was part of a motivation. And it was just this tiny piece of hope that, you know, maybe I will get through this, but I just didn't know how. I was dealing with severe pain, heavily medicated, dealing with a lot of like hallucinations, not knowing what was real and what wasn't. The nerve pain and whenever anybody touched me. I was also very nauseous from all the medication. So I was like vomiting all day long. And that was the physical side. And then the emotional side was just not believing that I was going to get better. Seeing my daughter there, I was very fortunate that they brought her into the hospital with me every day, basically. And she had a bassinet right beside my bed, and my mom would put her on my chest and try to get me to cuddle with her and everything. And so it was motivation, but it was also heartbreaking because I seen everybody else in my family taking care of her. And I just felt like I should be the one taking care of her. And so it was so hard to get out of that dark place. And I think anybody can relate when they're in that dark place. Sometimes it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, not to compare. Everyone's dark place could be different. And it's not that one is worse than the other or whatever. Never. You know, we've all had those experiences. I think there's not a person on the earth anymore who can say that they haven't been to a place of pure desperation for them. And everyone's experience, of course, is different. But, you know, what I think a lot of people don't understand is pain.
Yes.
You know, that physical pain that it can
makes
be so
you
distracting.
Die.
Yeah, yeah. It can be so distracting. Then you're talking about you're so medicated and the hallucinations were probably from opiates and things that they were trying to help you with. So I've talked to people on the show as well about opiates and what they do. And so you had that to contend with as well.
Yes, the pain. Yeah. And they brought in pain specialists, and it just was not going away. And it was torture. And I felt like I wanted to die. And like I said, like at one point I asked my respiratory therapist, and I said, please just let me rest. Let me die from this. I can't handle this any longer. But of course my family, they would not let that happen. And the doctors were fighting for me and the nurses. And so when I think of my strength, like a lot of people tell me, you're so strong and you're so amazing that you were able to get through that. But I like to kind of put it back on the people around me. And your support system can play such a huge role in pulling you out of those places. And so they were basically my strength on the days that I had none. And I went through such a dark time for so long that I didn't have any hope. And eventually the doctors, they saw that and they said, we need to give her something. And so they actually reached out to a previous GBS survivor who had actually been in the same hospital room that I had 2 years prior, and he had recovered. Wow. And so he agreed to come and see me, and he walked into my hospital room, like literally walked. And that was kind of a shining light for me, realizing that, you know what, if this guy went through what I did and he had been in the exact same position as I was, he was on a ventilator and mm-hmm. he had fully recovered and he was with his family and he was living his life. And it was at that point that I finally truly believed that, you know what, if somebody can get through this, then maybe I can too.
You can. Yeah. Can I ask you a personal question? It's not scripted. I didn't write this down, but you were talking about, you know, your family and your friends and all the people that are around you. And you have mentioned now that you're also divorced from your partner at the time. Did this experience change your relationship with people? And the only reason that I ask you this question is because I've talked to other people who have been through traumatic experiences. And although there were people there at the time who supported them, the dynamics of friendships and relationships change when you go through a significant trauma. Did anything like that happen with you and the people who you thought were going to be there forever?
Absolutely. Yes. It completely changed who I was as a person and how I viewed the world. I mean, I had friends that didn't come to the hospital to come see me. And so when I recovered, it was like, I was on my deathbed. I was almost dying. Yeah. Like, why? And so of course those relationships changed. My view on just certain people that, you know, they always had something negative going on in their life. And it was always, in my mind, it was always something very, very minor. And so then after going through something so traumatic, it was like, you don't even understand what real pain is.
What it really is like. Yeah.
Yeah. And I found it really difficult to be around people. My relationship with my coworkers and my boss changed a lot as well after I returned to work, because they there was just so many things that they were picking things apart at work, and it was like, you have no idea. Like, it doesn't matter. Life is so
you're
short.
So trivial. Yeah, yeah.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and yeah. So in the end, it did affect my relationship or my marriage, and I had just changed so much after I had mm-hmm. recovered, and I saw things so differently because I had basically been given my life back after going through what I thought I would never get through.
You were on the brink of death. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so I saw things differently, and I wanted to live my life very differently. And I wanted to just basically go after things that I had always wanted to go after, that I'm going to do this one day, but you know, you never do, right? One day I will. And so when
one
I got out
comes.
Of Yeah. One day never comes. And so when I got out of the hospital, I said, one day is now, and I'm making these changes. And so of course, then that does affect a relationship when one person is drastically changing and the other person isn't. I'll be honest. I mean, my relationship, how I seen it before I was going through GBS was very differently than how I seen it after. And after going through what I did, I saw it differently, and I realized how toxic and unhealthy it was. And I tried to make changes. And in the end, I realized that, you know what, life is too short. And I did have to leave that relationship.
Sure. Also, other people don't like it when you change. I've learned that through my own personal experiences, but also through talking to other people on the show where you make where the changes you make are so drastic too, people don't like it. And they don't like you to be moving faster, or it's hard to, but you know what I'm talking about.
They don't
want you to be doing better than them, you know, and that's why friends and other people, but we tend to hang on to them. And I don't know whether it's because of fear or something like that. Thank you. I'm glad that I asked that question, because I didn't have it scripted here, and I just thought, actually, you've mentioned this now, and I wondered, when you go through, because even people who have been through depression, you know, if you go through a very serious bout of depression, sometimes relationships can change when you come out the other side of that. People don't like you to be happy. Yes. Which sounds really shitty. Like
it does.
That sounds really crappy to say that, but actually it's the truth. And only people who have been through an experience like that can probably relate to the fact that actually people around me don't want me to, they want me to be miserable. And it may be a caretaker thing and whatever, but I guess the most important message from that is it's about you and not about them.
Yes, exactly.
And we say that all the time on this show.
Yeah. Well, and you'll learn more as you read the book as well. So I do touch on that as well.
What I felt about the book, I've said that actually this is, so it's called, it's got a really long title. So it is called Life Support, Surviving Guillain-Barré Syndrome, A Mother's Story of Hope and Recovery. But also, I feel as though, although it is a personal account of your journey, it's a bit of a support. And I wonder if it ties back into people maybe being a support for people. You know, you're the guy who walked in and he inspired you in a way.
Exactly.
So is that what this is about? Did you want to share this? It is a resource guide. I can see how that could be, but is that what inspired you to share your story and maybe become a voice for people who were suffering?
Exactly. So after I recovered and basically got out of ICU, I just seen things so differently. It was like this happened to me for a reason. And I was trying to explain to people what it was like to be in ICU and what it was like to be paralyzed and what it was like to learn how to breathe on my own and learn how to walk again and learn how to do everything. I basically had to do it all and go through very intense physiotherapy. And it was so hard to explain that to other people in like 5 minutes. You just can't.
Yeah.
And one of my doctors was like, you have been through so much and you're such an inspiration. And I hope you realize that. And I swear to God, you could write a book one day. And he was joking. But when he said it, I instantly was like, wow, I should write a book. I had always wanted to write a book, but I had nothing had happened to me before. And so I started writing. And that was one of the reasons that I had, when I was going through learning how to breathe on my own in ICU, it was so scary. I didn't think I was going to be able to ever get off that ventilator. They would basically shut off the ventilator for seconds at a time, like 15 seconds, and I would have to breathe on my own. And it was terrifying. And I felt like I was going to die. And they would put me back on after 15 seconds and I would be hyperventilating and crying and going, I can't do this. And the guy that actually came and visited me, he brought in a sign and he put it on my wall and it said, I will never forget it. It'll say, courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes it's the quiet voice saying, I will try again tomorrow. And so I would stare at that sign and I would go, okay, well, I can always try again tomorrow. And so I would try again the next day and I would do 30 seconds and I would cry and think I can never do this. And then the next day I would try again. It would be 45 seconds. And slowly over time, I was able to improve that and improve my lung strength, and eventually I was able to last 72 hours and I was able to get out of ICU and get off the ventilator. It was a long road, and I remember thinking, I truly believed I'm never going to be able to get off this ventilator. I'll never be able to breathe on my own. And so once I had done that, and once I had realized, you know what, we can do hard things, we can do things that you sometimes think you won't be able to. And I knew that, you know what, I've recovered now. I want to show other people that are maybe going through this, or their family members who have somebody in ICU fighting for their life. I want to show them that, see, I did it. And so can you. So I wanted to give somebody else that hope. And so that's why I wrote the book.
I don't know if I'm going to come to that in the book, but did you have to relearn everything? Or was it just like, I'm getting better and different things are coming back to me? You had to learn to walk, talk, breathe. Well, you don't want to learn to breathe, but
So basically it was just, it's kind of like muscle strength and in everything. And so with my lungs and with my vocal cords, even like I even had to re-strengthen that. And so basically just every single muscle in my body had to learn how to re-strengthen itself. And so I had to learn how to hold cutlery and basically how to feed myself. And so just regaining that strength. And I lost 30 pounds in the hospital of basically muscle mass. And so it was having to regain that weight and put on the muscle that I'd lost so that I had the strength. I remember like trying to hold my hand up to my mouth to feed myself and just barely being able to do it. And everything was just so challenging. And so I had to re-strengthen my fingers. I would put them in putty and basically try to stretch them out. And I remember it feeling like cement. And then I had to learn how to brush my hair and all that stuff. And so just, I had to do intense physiotherapy for a very long time, just gradually strengthening those muscles until I was able to get a little bit stronger. Eventually I was able to get out of bed and I was in a wheelchair for quite a while. And that's how we got around. But it's so interesting because I mean, you think of like, even now, like I'm fully recovered and I was in a wheelchair, but in that moment, that was better than being in the hospital bed paralyzed. I was ecstatic to be in a wheelchair. I was able to get out of my room and move around. And then eventually I was able to do exercises. I would strengthen my legs with my physiotherapist and they would actually put me on an exercise bike and they bought me a monkey bar to put in my hospital bed that I could like pull myself up. So I had to really, really work very, very hard. And eventually I was able to stand. So I stood alongside my hospital bed and stood for 30 seconds at a time. And again, I mean, the entire journey felt so hard. And there was many times throughout the process that I thought, am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to recover completely? Am I ever going to be able to run with my daughter? Am I going to be left over using like a cane or I just didn't know, but I always just maintained that hope. And I just promised myself that I would keep trying and I would always just, you know, keep moving forward. And eventually I did. Yeah. Eventually I was moved to a rehab hospital where I learned how to walk. And I progressed to a walker and that's how I got around for a while. And then I was able to move to a cane. And then after 126 days in the hospital, I was moved home.
Amazing. Amazing. I remembered a question that I had written here because you were talking about how you were learning everything. In addition to becoming a mother, you also became, and this is amazing because I forgot that I'd written this question. So I've obviously seen something somewhere. You became a certified fitness trainer after you recovered. How did your experience with GBS shape your approach to fitness and then help you connect with others who were struggling? Because you're talking about you lost all this weight, et cetera, et cetera. I've talked about this numerous times on the show that since COVID, I'm really overweight. I gained a lot of weight over COVID. And I am now at a point where I'm looking at myself and I do not see a way, apart from maybe major surgery and lots of money because it's not free, you know, like to go and have my stomach reduced or something. But that is the kind of stuff I'm not interested in. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be, you know, but I've tried yoga. I've tried Tai Chi. I have swelling and I've got nerve pain. And sometimes it's so hard for me to walk. It's so hard for me to get up off of my chair and move. And I know I have to move.
Yes. It's so challenging.
But I feel
it really is.
Yeah. I just have zero motivation at all. The only motivation that I have really is that I need to lose weight and I don't want to die.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's tough. I mean, after I recovered and after I had use of my body, I mean, I spent a lot of time at the rehab hospital where there was a lot of people that were completely paralyzed from car accidents and other very serious disorders and other random diseases that I'd never heard of as well.
Yeah.
And, they were paralyzed for life and probably no chance of them walking again. So then when I was learning how to walk and eventually recovered well enough that I could actually run and do things, it just gave me this intense appreciation for my body and for what it was capable of doing. And so I started exercising because I knew that my recovery was on me. And I knew that if I wanted to continue getting stronger, because I was still pretty weak when I was at home, I couldn't squat down. Like, that was very, very difficult for me to do. It was hard for me to lift my daughter in my arms. It was hard to go up the stairs. It was challenging to walk for long periods of time. And so I knew that if I wanted to get stronger, I had to just work at it really, really hard. And just like being in ICU, I mean, being on the ventilator was such an eye-opening experience that, you know what, things don't come easy and you have to really, really work at it. And so I just promised myself I'd be consistent. And that's what I've really found with exercise, is just the consistency is just sticking to it and just not giving up and just trying again tomorrow. And I started exercising and I just started to fall in love with it, because for me personally, not everybody is the same, but for me, I found that it did help with my pain. It reduced it. It also helped with my fatigue. I was very, very fatigued and got very tired quickly. And so when I was exercising regularly, I found that I had more energy, which motivated me to kind of keep going. And eventually I was able to get into the best shape of my life. And I had never really exercised before I had gone through GBS.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. If you did this before.
No, yeah. I really didn't. And so the human body is just wild. It's just amazing to see that I could go from completely paralyzed and to then in the best shape of my life. And so I wanted to show other people, and I wanted to just motivate them as well. I had a lot of people reaching out, asking me questions, saying, well, how did you do it? What did you do? What moves did you do? What exercises did you do? And how did you get there? I want to be there. And I didn't really feel comfortable giving them advice, because I wasn't a trainer and I didn't know much, right? And so that inspired me to actually go after my certification. And so I got certified so that I could learn as much as I could. I didn't know where it was going to take me. I didn't know if it was just going to be kind of to learn for myself and maybe be able to answer some questions. But in the end, after I got certified, I started just kind of sharing my story and talking about what I'd been through. And I had GBS survivors reaching out to me. And so I was able to work with many, many survivors then and help regain their strength.
Fantastic. It's inspirational. And like you say, tomorrow, try again. So I'm going to put that in my head, and I do keep trying, and I try to get, 5 to 10 minutes of yoga, because I have such pain and I just have to keep trying, I guess. I need to build it up and keep persevering.
Persevering, and just, sometimes you just got to do what you can, right? And it's just realizing that, you know what, you may not be able to do these intense, crazy workouts, but that's okay, right? Just doing whatever works for you. So even I advise a lot of people to just start with walking, even just going for a walk, which is great for your mental health even as well, right? Yoga is great as well for stretching, and it's just a little bit, anything. And then that, once you get that ball rolling, once you get into that groove, then that's when you can start adding or changing up things. But I usually just try to say, like, just stick with what you're enjoying in the moment and just be consistent with that for a while.
I will do that. I'm gonna put it in my head, and I'm gonna do that. Before I let you go, because we're almost out of time, I wanted to mention that you also work with the GBS and CIDP Foundation of Canada. Can you explain what they are? And the reason that you are, so what you do is you help to raise awareness and support for people who are living not just with GBS, but with autoimmune illnesses. Do you have any advice for people who may be struggling with something like a similar condition, not necessarily GBS, but any kind of autoimmune illness? How can we be the best support for people who are in need?
So I think there's a few different things. So GBS Foundation of Canada, that I discovered after I had recovered. And when you're going through a rare illness and you think that you're the only one in the world who has it, and then you find out that there's all these other people that have it too. And I found this foundation, and I knew immediately that I wanted to be a part of them. And so I connected with them, and I started volunteering with them, raising awareness, just talking about my disorder and talking about it on social media, I started going to awareness campaigns. We started making conferences, connecting with other patients, even visiting patients in the hospital. So I've done that many times where I've walked into somebody else's hospital room and showed them, you know, look, I recovered too, and I was where you were, and there is always hope. And so it's a huge part of my life now. And I do view my situation that I went through, everything with GBS, I view it as a positive, even though it's so crazy to think that it was so horrible. But I found the blessings within. And so what I say to people that are going through an illness or you know what, anything is try to find other people that maybe have already gotten through it or who are going through it at the same time. And so somebody that you can relate to, somebody that truly understands, because I mean, my family and friends, they were amazing. They were so supportive, but they just couldn't understand what it's like. And so when I went to my first GBS conference and I walked into the room and we're talking about nerve pain and we're talking about being on the ventilator and we're talking about all the stuff that happens in ICU and in hospitals, it's your people. You feel like you've met your family. And so that's a huge advice that I say is don't do this alone. Don't go through this alone. Reach out to people. Social media, it can be such a negative place, but it can also be an incredible way to connect with other people around the world, no matter where you are. So find those resources. Always just kind of maintain that hope, even on the darkest days. You know, today's a bad day. I'm just hoping that there's going to be better days coming, and giving ourselves grace. I think I've met a lot of people that are so hard on themselves for the bad days, and they think I should be positive all the time. And I'm dealing with fatigue and pain. And I mean, that's not your fault, right? It's you're dealing with an autoimmune disorder or a struggle of some sort. And it's not your fault that you're sick. And so you got to give yourself some grace. And one thing that really helped me when I've gone through lots of bouts of serious fatigue, many times I've actually even been hospitalized a few times because it's gotten so severe. And so I've learned how to really listen to my body, not push myself too hard. It's finding that balance, but then allowing myself, you know what, on the bad days, those are your days you're catching up on Netflix. You're catching up on emails. Yeah. You're listening to podcasts, and that's not a wasted day. That's the day that you need to heal and you just need to let your body relax, and you shouldn't beat yourself up over it.
We do really need to change our mindset about that. That I was seeing something about this, one of the groups that I'm in on social media, where they posted something, stop shaming people for sleeping during the day, as something as simple as that, because it seems to be a big thing. Isn't that bad?
I love that. It is. And after going through GBS, I had to nap all the time, but it was truly what my body needed. And sleep is so important for me personally, but for the majority of people is if you're not getting a good enough sleep, then how can you function at all generally?
You just can't function.
Exactly. So there's a lot of pillars of that you need in place. Like your sleep is number one. And then for me, I believe that like the exercise and eating properly, those are just going to get you to a better place than if you didn't do it at all.
I it really resonated with me, especially the stop shaming people for sleeping, and also stop shaming yourself.
Exactly.
That's probably like the biggest point to take from that. Stop shaming yourself. If you have to sleep in the daytime, go and sleep in the daytime. Like,
exactly.
What is with that? Why do we have this thing where we need to judge people for sleeping?
I know. If your body is telling you you're tired, listen to your body. Yeah, and I've pushed myself for many, many years. After I recovered from GBS, I tried to do everything because I just wanted to do it all because I was so excited to be. I could, And I remember one time, like, I'm a runner and I enjoy running. And I said, I want to do a 10K run. And so I did it and I literally crashed and could not move for several days. And I was in such a dark place after that. And I thought, why did I do that? Like, you don't need to. So learn to listen to your body. And if it's telling you to nap during the day, have a nap.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And stop feeling shame about it. I think that's really important. And it's a message that I really want to drive that home. First of all, stop shaming other people. Mind your own freaking business. And I think that people have the hardest time with that, minding their own business. And social media, although it is not 100% responsible, it has a lot to answer for as far as people seeming to have an opinion and they think that their opinion is warranted. And you're allowed to have an opinion, but we don't all have to hear it. So stop shaming people about things.
Yes, absolutely. Because until you've been in that experience, and that can be any experience in the world, and until you've been in that person's life and lived their life, there is no way that you will ever be able to understand.
You don't understand.
So there's no point in even trying to shame somebody.
Exactly.
Because you don't know.
Exactly. Holly, you are truly inspirational. You have such an incredible story, and I thank you so much for joining us and sharing that with us. Like, now I'm reading the book and I want other people to go and have a look again. It's called Life Support Surviving Guillain-Barré Syndrome. So you're going to have to learn how to spell that word. A mother's story of hope and recovery. And it truly is. Also, how is Casey? What is she now? 12 years old?
She is 12 years old. It's wild. And she's actually taller than me now. It's crazy. And it's made me really appreciate being a mom and being able to do all these things that I worried I wouldn't be able to do one day. And so our bond, I think, is even stronger than had I not gone through GBS. And the book Life Support, it's on Amazon, but you can just type in Life Support and Holly Francis. You don't need to type in Guillain-Barré Syndrome. But it really
but I
is.
Want you to.
yes. But it really
I want
is
you to.
Just
do it.
It's a really inspirational story, and you certainly don't need to have an autoimmune disorder or have gone through GBS for it to resonate. I think just to realize that, you know what, we are all so much stronger than we realize. You don't realize you're strong until you go through these traumatic experiences. But if I can get through what I did, I think anybody can overcome it.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to finishing it off. HollyAfterGBS.com is your website, and you're on the socials as well, which I'll find them and people can have a look in the show notes and they can link up with you. Thank you again. It has been such a wonderful experience. And I think I like how this went.
It was wonderful. I loved it.
It felt good.
It felt really good.
I mean, it wasn't, and everybody, you don't have to freak out. It's still unscripted. Like pretty much all of what we went through was unscripted. I kept some notes, and I think I'm in law school, so I'm getting better at making notes now. Like, I'm learning how to do them a little bit better. So maybe I'm just like, I'm maturing a little bit. And I think I like how that's going to go with the podcast. So awesome. Let me know what you think, everybody. Feel free to leave a 5-star review. Don't leave less than 5, by the way, because that's just crappy. If you want to leave less than 5, at least have a real reason. There was someone who left a 4-star review, but their comment didn't match. They were like, I really love the show and this and that, whatever. And it was a 4-star review. What is that?
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing that? Leave me a 5-star review. If you want to leave me less, let me know why.
Yes.
And I'll try to make it better, and I'll try to make up, like, get you to the 5, you know?
Yes, exactly.
How can I push you to the 5-star review? Don't forget to follow us on social media. I don't know what they are. They're somewhere linked there. I'm also getting better with social media, so you can talk to me there and I'm interacting with you all. Holly Francis, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you everybody for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.